I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
I'm
supposed to drink out of the pitcher?
Whatever way you want.
Excuse me while I pour me some water. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. And by God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous rooms full of people like you in a fast backfield. It hadn't been necessary for me to do no dope or drink no whiskey since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm forever grateful. It's a privilege for me to be here. It's a privilege for me to be anywhere, but it's a special privilege for me to be this far from home without a leash. And I want to thank Ed and Don for their warm hospitality and for making me welcome. I wasn't, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't welcome anywhere. Nobody was expecting me, and nobody was sending for me. And so I didn't have a whole lot of places to go since I was sobered up. I've been asked to come a few places, and the biggest gift of that is I've been asked to come back a couple of times, so that's kind of neat. I was born in Texas, and that isn't reason enough to a drink, but it's a good reason to get drunk, so that you don't get it confused, the difference between a Texas tale and a fairy tale. A fairy tale starts out once upon a time. And a Texas tale starts out, you're probably not going to believe this shit, but I'm going to tell you anyway. And my drunkalogue is really very simple. It says that you're supposed to share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today in a general way. I used to sit around my house and drink a little beer and think maybe I'd do something. I'd smoke a little dope and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And then I'd shoot a little speed so I'd have the strength to do it. And I'd snort a little coke so I was cool when I did it. And I'd drink a little whiskey and forget I did it. So. That about sums that up. I'm a real alcoholic. I don't identify with anybody who specializes. I'm a pig. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous thinking maybe I wish I should have drank some of that or shot some of that or snorted some of that. I did it all. And I'm grateful I was able to do that. And I go as far back as picking cotton with them benzodrine inhalers back when they were fan type, to where the point it was that it wasn't in between drinks. It wasn't nothing for me to stick a needle in my arm. So. And I'm grateful that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so burnt down that they said, you're just an alcoholic. And I said, okay, call me anything and I'll drag along. And I did. I drank alcohol until I achieved pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, bought myself a bag of weed and a Harley Davidson, became a legend in my own mind. There's some legends in here, I can feel them. You know, I really would like to tell you that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of reasons, but I really came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of Al-Anon brutality. And, I married a pre-Al-Anon, and she wasn't my first wife, but she had what it took to hang in there. And I met her, I was living in a little town in Texas Panhandle, and I wasn't doing nothing. I mean, I was kind of in between, you know, when you're not doing nothing, when you're getting off of a divorce and you don't have a job and you don't have a driver's license, you don't have a car and you don't have no money, and you're just drinking, not doing nothing. And I, you know, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. So it doesn't really make any difference there. I'm a fourth generation alcoholic. My grandpappy and his father were both real drunks, and they died drunk. My grandpappy, he died when he was 89. He got loaded and on corn whiskey and shot some dope and died back in Oklahoma Panhandle. And when you're an old Froop 89 back in Oklahoma Panhandle and you OD like that, you're not any big legend like you are in California, but not a lot of people come to your funeral either. So, you know, he was just that way, running to the end, and that was all it was. And my daddy's an alcoholic. He's sober 7 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a little seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget it. When he sobered up, he called me up and asked me if I'd be his sponsor, and I said, no, I'd rather be your spiritual advisor. But I have a good relationship with him today. He's just my father, and that's he's not my lawyer, he's not my bondsman, he's not my brother or crime partner, he's just my father, and I'm grateful for that. And I was standing around not doing nothing back there, and midnight, whenever it was Saturday night, whenever you're not doing much, one of them country dances, why, I usually started the fight. I usually, about midnight, if I didn't have something else going, why, I mean, drinking was a contact sport for me. And at intermission, well, I'd roll a Coke bottle down to the dance floor and said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring it back, and it looked like a stampede coming my way. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of those guys that lost a lot of fights. I started a lot of fights, and I didn't stay around until they were over. So I won a lot of fights. And what I did whenever the fight started, I went to the women's restroom, and I'm... On the way to the woman's restroom, while there was this lady standing there, and I said, when the heat gets off, what, tell me. And I went in and hid out in the woman's restroom. And pretty soon this lady come in and told me, said, you can come out now. And I went out, and like a good person, I asked her to dance. And it was a fast dance, and we danced, and we went around, around, around. I thought, well, anybody can keep up with that and doing that good. Besides that, I found out she had a job, had a car, had a driver's license, had some money. So I asked her for a date. And we started a 2-year romance that was just living screaming hell, and she survived that, and I found out that she healed quick. And so I asked her to marry me, and we got married, and we had a little girl, and that was kind of my childhood, you know. And after a certain period of time, I got the heck out of Oklahoma. I come to California, and they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that's geographic, but at that time it was unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I loaded up this lady and a little girl and a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me and a cat that hated me. I had a cat that hated me. If you want to make a cat hate you, when it's a small cat, take it down and get it neutered and let it know who did it. I made a terrible mistake. I forgot to get the cats declawed at the same time. And I left Oklahoma City with a bag of pills that my friend got out of a pharmacy for me. His girlfriend got them in the middle of the night in the blackout, and there was red ones and green ones and big ones and little ones, and I don't know what they all were. You'd take a handful of them and stay up for 3 days, take a handful of them, and you'd go out for 3 days. It took me 30 days to go from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. I finally got here with this crazy lady and this dog and this cat and this kid and this woman. She's hanging out on the right side of the car because there had no mirror over there, and the cops arrested me for not having a mirror on one side, and had a trailer with all my stuff in the back, and you know, I was just crazy, and I finally landed in a little place down in Southern California and found a house that was just right for me. Nobody lived in it for a couple of years, and one of the best dope connections was on one side, and the Haitians lived on the other side, and they were doing mud wrestling before it was popular. And it had no front yard. It had about 3 yards of gravel in the backyard in one big pile. And I took up residency there and put this laying little kid and dog and a cat in that house. And then I geographic, and I worked in the oil field. I was a drunk roughneck, and I'm a sober roughneck, and I took off, and I'd go off for 4 or 5 weeks, and then I'd come home, because you get tired when you're out there, you know. I'm basically, a speed freak and took a lot of amphetamines in between beers. And if you don't know what a speed freak is, it's like going 150 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor, you know what I mean? You can carry on lengthy conversations with no one, you know. And your teeth grind a lot, and your blackouts are short, and you don't really care what you're drinking just as long as it keeps your mouth wet, you know. And my biggest fear was that my body was going to die and my head was going to keep on living, you know. And you get tired when you're doing that, and periodically I'd have to come home and I'd call this woman up and say, "I'm coming home," and she'd say, "Where are you?" And I'd say, "I don't know, but I'll be there pretty soon." And I might be in Louisiana, and I'd start out for home, and I'd get close to home, and you gotta have something to settle your nerves when you get close to home, and I'd take a little speed so that I could get on home, but I didn't want to take too much because you end up in Vegas when you take too much, you know? And I'd get a couple of half pints and put them on the seat to kind of keep me mellowed out so I could get to the house, and I'd get about, I don't know, a couple of blocks from the house and reach over to get one of them bottles and hit the curb and knock the right front tire out and ricochet around, and I had an old Edsel in the Corvair in my front yard so that when I run into something, I knew that, you know, I was home. And I'd end up out in the front yard, and then I'd have to make that decision that you always have to make, how to get in the house. And I could go in the house through the dog run, but if you ain't cleaned the dog run in 5 or 6 weeks, that's a big job. Or you can go through the front door. It isn't too big a deal to go through the front door, because this woman was nuts in there. And she'd set up these booby traps. She had old pots in there and stuff so that whenever I come running through the front door, if she was asleep or hiding someplace, she'd know I was home. I always carried a lot of guns on me and run through the front door and step in one of them pots, and I always wore cowboy boots, and when your toe turns up in one of them pots, it's hard to get your .38 out of your boot. And you're stomping around in there, and this crazy woman, she's carried a butcher knife about 12 inches long. She's always waving it around, you know, and it's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob, man. I opened that door, and she's just screaming at me all the time. I'd stick a .38 in her mouth, and she wouldn't shut up. She'd still talk, you know, and she'd stick that knife in my stomach and say, "You go first." And the dog would be biting me in the ass, and the cat would be scratching, and the kid would be bawling. I'm trying to say, "Daddy's home, for Christ's sake. I come all this way to come home and mow the yard and fix the house, you know." And they weren't paying attention. I'd go in and lay down for a while, and then about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, wake right up, run right in the kitchen, because I knew I had a lot of things to do. Go in there and get 150 mini beans, put them in the blender, a little orange juice, a couple of raw eggs, turn that baby on, get you a big iced tea glass, pour it full of vodka, hit it a couple of times with a little Tabasco so you can call it the Bloody Mary, and then you drink that and drink that, and then you go in the garage and look for a lawnmower. Yeah. It's out there somewhere under all them high-priority projects you've been going to do. And about 5:30 in the morning, you find the lawnmower, but you can't find the rope. But that's okay, because them 150 mini bennies will hit you in the ass, and you can push start your lawnmower with that. And then you get it out in the front yard, and you get going, and you know, you didn't change the gas in it, and the gas turned to varnish, and it dies in the middle of the front yard. And I had no muffler on my lawnmower. I wanted everybody to know I was out there doing something. And I always had a mono. If it didn't run, shoot it. And it would die in the front yard, and I'd kill it. And then the cops would come. 6 o'clock in the morning, the cops would come, and I'd have to run my head into the nightstick. And do that 5 or 6 times out in the front yard. Then the woman would come out, and I'd swear that I'd calm down, and I'd go back in the house, and I'd get depressed. Be about 6:30, 7 o'clock Saturday morning, I'm depressed. I have no depression chair in my house. There's no, well, them vinyl recliners kind of lean. They had a lot of burnt places where that bad dope and seeds would fly out of there. But it was just right so you could lay there and suck on a can of beer or a bottle of wine. And I had a sawed-off shotgun I kept on the side of that chair because I wanted everybody to know I got depressed. And when I got depressed, I was going to commit suicide. And I'd jack that old gun back and stick the barrel in my mouth and click it when the woman and the kid would walk by, because I wanted to know I was getting depressed. It was empty, of course. Once I was just ready to click, and I seen, as I slammed the shell, I seen something red go by there, and I pulled it off the side and clicked it, and she'd put a shell in that gun. I couldn't hear out of that ear for 3 days. Blowed the air conditioner right out of the window, man. And we got in a hell of a fight over the fact that it was July and the air can almost ruin the air conditioner. And I think it was a couple of days before it dawned on me that I could have killed my neighbor if he'd have been walking by there, you know. And then the cops would come and I'd have to run my head into the nightstick again for a couple of 3 times. And then I'd come back in the house and I'd say, I'm going to leave. And I'd grab something and start out the door. And usually what I grabbed was the keys to her car, because I'd run mine into the curb and the right front tire was flat. So I'd take her car and she'd come run out and stick her head in that window and grab the keys. And I'm trying to get down the driveway out and get the heck out of there. She's beating on me in there, and I pull back up in the driveway and shove her out, give it heck, and back out of the driveway, and just, you get down and start to turn, you look, and she'd be on the hood, beating on the window, you know? I don't know if there's any hood riders in here or not, but that'll scare you when you're trying to escape and there's a crazy woman on the hood. Then you have to pull back up in the driveway and go back in there and sit down for a little while and try to figure out another way to get out of there, you know? I did that for quite a while, and it got worse, and then it got worser, and I tried to commit suicide. I told my friends, I said, I got it all figured out how I'm going to commit suicide. I'm going to shoot it out with the cops, and so I had this idea. I always had a lot of cool guns. I had a couple of 45s with trick shoulder holsters with extra clips on, and loaded all up and took my clothes off. Come to the foot to Wild Turkey and pull a big chair in front of the front door. She seen me doing all that, run down the street, and I knew she was going to go call the cops like she always did. But I knew she was going to call them, and they were going to come down there. They was going to get out in the front yard, get the bullhorn out, and say, okay, drum, come on out, but I wasn't going out. And after they did that 2 or 3 times, they'd come kick the front door down, and then they'd draw, and I'd shoot, and they'd shoot, and I'd die, and it'd be in the front page. It'd be seen all over, my friends would see. Big shootout over there on my side of town. And I'm sitting in front of that door drinking that Wild Turkey, and she gave them the key to the front door. They didn't kick it down. They opened that door, and all of a sudden all the guns were on them. I didn't get a chance to draw. They said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to commit suicide. And they said, you need 2 guns and 4 clips and all that stuff. And I said, yeah, I'm bad shot when I'm drinking Wild Turkey, huh? And they'd take me over to Nutwood and put one of those funny coats on the zips in the back and put me in there in one of them rooms, and I'd lay down in there and they'd clamp my ankles and clamp my arms, and I'd lay there and scream and scream and scream, you know, like till your chest is about ready to explode. One time I stopped, and I wonder why I'm screaming. And I listened to this because them other guys in the other rooms were screaming, you know. And I'd start screaming again until I couldn't scream no more. And then they'd come and let me out, and they'd say, we'll give you one phone call, and I'd go make one phone call, and I'd call her. And I'd say, you got to get me out of this Nutwood. I'm not crazy. And she'd say, yeah, you are, and she'd hang up, and I'd tear the phone off the wall, and then turn around, and there'd be 6 psychiatrists standing there looking at me through a window, and that's good for 72 more hours, you know, and of observation, so they'd talk about my mother, and I'd talk about their mother. They finally gave me a little plastic card that said I was nuts and booed me out of there, and that was good for a few drinks down at the local bar. I could tell people I'm nuts. Look here, that little card says I'm crazy. And the only problem with that is that you get in trouble a lot with the law, and I was getting in trouble with the law an awful lot, and I found myself standing in front of a judge, and he's going to send me to penitentiary for 3 to 5 years for something I wasn't too sure that I'd done. I didn't remember it anyway. And I'd lost my job, and this woman had leaving me, and the dog wasn't even biting me, and the cat wasn't even scratching me, and the kid wasn't even crying anymore. I didn't understand all that, and they said, what we'll do, we'll send you to Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while. We'll postpone this sentence. They told me to call Alcoholics Anonymous, so They let me out of there, and I went home and called Alcoholics Anonymous, and some little gray-headed man come over to my house, and I mean, he pulled up out front, and I thought, oh, man, what am I going to tell my neighbors? I got to tell them my dad come to see me or something, you know? This little guy come waddling up there, man, I mean, he was disgraceful. I mean, I'd gotten a fight with a guy, and I wasn't too sure who won, but I had this bandana on my head with my ear had 100-some stitches in it where he tried to take my ear off. But I was ashamed to see this little gray-headed guy come up in my front yard. And so he come up and he talked to him about this and told him to show me this meeting. And I come back along about 6 o'clock and I told that woman, I said, I'm going to have Alcoholics Anonymous meeting over there at 8:30 or 10. Might go to it. So I laid around there for a little while. And about 8:15, she jumped up and grabbed that butcher knife. And I said, what are you going to do? And she said, I'm going to take you to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So I went out and got in the car. They'd taken all my guns, and I went out and got in the car, and she pulled up in front of that meeting, and she said, I'm going to tell you what, Ace, if you come out of that door before 10 o'clock, I'm going to gut you. So you can keep a drunk sober for a period of time if you got a big enough knife. And I went to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had a bunch of old food sitting in there, and they said stupid stuff like, you got to work the steps, you got to get a sponsor, you got to go to a meeting every day. And I wasn't real into that. And so I hung around there for one meeting a week for 4 months. An amazing thing happened. One meeting a week, 4 months. I got back in the bedroom, got my job back, the judge let me off, the dog sitting right there beside that chair, I could pet that dog, the cat was laying in my lap, and the kid was sitting over there, pat the kid on the head, and I thought, yeah, I've been too hard on myself, you know? I think I'm premature here, you know? And I went back to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told them, guys, I don't want to work the steps. I don't want to get a sponsor. I don't want to go to any more meetings. And some old fruit looked at me and said, you must be in BB. I said, what the hell's that? And he says, I don't know, but in here in AA, we do that stuff, see? And I wasn't really, really an alcoholic. And if you ain't really, really, I mean really an alcoholic, you ain't really an alcoholic. And I went back out there, and all of a sudden one of them drinks jumped right up in my hand. And I was in Dallas, Texas, and I drank a gin Mary. And then I had another one. I didn't stand up, take my clothes off. And get in a lot of trouble. I did, however, go up in my room and open up my little overnight bag, and there was a little bottle I'd been carrying around for 4 months. It had some Quaaludes and some Reds and some good stuff in there. I took all that and drank some more. Next day I got into L.A. and I had to get a wheelchair to get me off the airplane. And I started one of them drunks that lasted me 3.5 years. And all the yets that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, see, when I was in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, one meeting a week for 4 months, I didn't identify. But in the next 3.5 years, I found some identity. In the next 3.5 years of my life, there was nothing cute or funny about it. There was nothing but living, screaming hell because I'm a violent drunk. I was full of fear. I used to say I was an angry little boy and I grew up to be an angry man, but what I am is a scared little boy and I grew up to be a scared little boy. And I was afraid inside. I was full of fear, and there was the only way I knew how to cover that fear up was with anger and violence. All my life, I attracted the things I feared the most. If I was afraid I was going to lose it, I held onto it harder and tighter. And I wouldn't let it go until I smothered it into nothing. I didn't know you could attract the things you love the most. I didn't know that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. But in the next 3.5 years, a lot of things happened in my life, and I'm not proud of it, but I'm grateful that I know about it today. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says our past is our greatest asset, and that I have no secrets in that area of my life. When I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous 3.5 years later, my sponsor made me go down and check some of these things out. And what I had to take a look at was me. Because when I sobered up, I found out I was what I thought I was. In the next 3.5 years of my life, I was arrested 57 times for assault and battery and resisting arrest, and 31 of those times had to do with me beating my wife and my daughter. I beat them physically, mentally, and spiritually. because I was full of fear and rage. And the alcoholic disease in that home just eroded all the feelings until there was nothing. There was no hate. There was nothingness in that house. I might be standing in my kitchen on any given morning taking a hit off a bottle of booze. And my daughter lived in the room down to the end of the hallway, and she usually didn't change her clothes when I was around there. And she had a couple old brown bags with everything she had in it, and she might have a few dollars that her mama gave her to hold on to because at any given moment they had to run. And she had her chin on her chest and her hair in her face, and she had no friends. And I might take a hit off that jug and look down that hallway at her, and she'd be standing down there or sitting down there, squatted down, and she'd look at me. And she didn't run up that hallway and say, "Daddy, I wish you wouldn't do that." She never ran up there and grabbed me by the leg and said, "Daddy, don't do that today." She watched me to see which direction I was going to go, because she had to go the other way. And I might be standing in my bathroom, like on several occasions I was standing in there, I don't know, any time of the day or night. And I remember one time in particular when I was in there cooking up a load of dope and I was getting ready to put it in that syringe, and I looked around, there's a crack in the door about like that, and there was a mirror there. And a little 9.5-year-old girl was looking in that mirror. And just for a second, my eyes caught hers. She didn't open my door and say, "Daddy, what you doing? Please don't do that." She was watching me to see what direction I was going to go, because she had to go the other way. And I remember turning back around, going ahead and doing what I knew I had to do, because I didn't have any other choice, and looking back, and without a sound or any kind of motion, she was gone. You see, that's the way I was. And I might be sitting at a stoplight, 6 o'clock in the morning, taking a hit off a bottle of vodka, and I might be sitting there in my old truck with the window down, and some dude sitting next to me with clean clothes on, because he's going to work. I'd take a hit off that jug, and I'd look at him, and he'd look at me, and he'd look at me with that look of contempt, and I might say, "What the hell are you looking at?" Because I'm in the gutter looking down on them people. I had no choice. I had to take that drink just to get to the next light. Just to get to the next light. And I might get to the next light, and there might be some woman with her kids in there, and she's getting ready to drop them off the babysitter because she's going to work. So she's sitting in that car, and she looks at me with that look of contempt, and I look at her and take a hit off that jug, and I'd say, "What the hell are you looking at?" Because I had to have that drink just to get to the next light. And I might be sitting around my house on any given day, and that little girl, because she had no friends, she brought old dogs home. And she'd bring those stray dog home, and she'd love and pet on that dog. And I might sit there and watch her love and pet on that dog. And I'd be jealous and envious because she had a love for an animal that she was supposed to have for me, and I knew she was supposed to have it for me. And on more than one occasion, I killed those dogs right in front of her, and one time I shot a dog right in front of her. And if you don't think that doesn't do something to a kid's mind, you're wrong. It takes them to the point where there's no hate. It takes them to the point where there's nothing. Survival. Nothing. And that's the kind of animal I am. That's the kind of animal that stuff took me. You know, they say that you can take everything away from a human being. You can take their family, you can take their job, you can take their money, you can take all the things that we prize so greatly, and they'll still resemble a human being. But when you take away a person's dignity, there's nothing left to lose, and they're as near an animal as you can be. In that next 2.5 years of my drinking, it was necessary for me to take another man's life. Because I was running around people that you had to keep your image of, and you had to prove yourself, because I'm slipping and I'm falling down, and I was hanging on with all my ability. I run around with people that you had to do things like that. You had to act like that. You had to put up that wall. Fear was in front of me just like so devastating that I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't even hardly talk. And I had to perform. I had to do those things. And I had to take another man's life. And it made me a cut above. It made me something. It rose me up out of that gutter and made me something. Yet down deep inside, I knew it was wrong. And I never spent a day behind bars. I won. I beat the deal. And yet I might wake up in the middle of the night, 1:30 in the morning, I come home, and I might be laying in that bed in a pool of sweat. And I jump straight up out of that bed and look to see if I murdered my wife, because just a matter of time till I did that. Or I might jump up out of that bed and run down the hall and look in there to see if that little girl's in there, and go in and listen and see if she's breathing. because it was just a matter of time till I murdered her. Because that's the kind of person I was. As it was going away from me, I was hanging on to it with all my ability, choking it to death. And you see, I'm the kind of an alcoholic, as long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that'll roll over when I snap my fingers, I won't look at me. I'll always look down on you. And I had to go to the point where there was nobody left. Nobody left. I'm grateful for that. You know, the 12 and 12, in the first step, it says in there, in the next to the last paragraph of step number one, it says an alcoholic must hit a bottom. And I like to say, beyond which he cannot go. Before they will be willing to do what's necessary to be done in the next 11 steps just to stay alive. Just to stay alive. Don't say nothing about all kinds of wonderful things. Just to stay alive. And I had to get to that point. When I got to that point, I come crawling back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for that because the seed had been planted. When that little gray-headed man came to my house that day, he gave me that seed. And when I got myself to that point, but nobody wanted me, I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. And I'm grateful for that. And I crawled back into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful that I found the place where they took me in, and they didn't say, well, you got to be a pure alcoholic. They looked at my arms, and they looked at me, and they looked me in the eye, and they said, do you want to live that way anymore? And I said, no, and they let me come in. They didn't label me a dope fiend or any kind of stuff like that. They said, you can be an alcoholic if you want to. All you got to do is walk in here and say you are one. And I came into an alcoholic detox, and I'm grateful for that. Because a big deal like me, see, it was any time I was in a nut ward or a jailhouse or locked up in some joint or something, I'd had some kind of a mental relapse or I'd had some kind of a bad deal or a bum rap. But when you end up in an alcoholic detox, you're a real alcoholic. It's pretty hard to beat that deal. And I ended up in that detox, and they gave me the tools. They told me how to get a sponsor, and they told me how to work the steps, and they told me I was going to have to go to a lot of meetings. They said a guy like me is going to have to go to a meeting every day for at least 22 years, and then I'd come back and ask them to have a day off. And I said, I don't understand this God stuff. They got too much God stuff. And some old foof looked at me and said, there's only one thing you got to know about God, Ace. There is one, and you ain't him. And that really simplified that for me. I didn't fight it much after that. The only problem I had was, you see, I was full of fear. You know, when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization was, after I sobered up, I found out I was exactly what I thought I was. And I sat in the back rows of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and radiated hate. I'm grateful for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in California, and especially Southern California, because there's all kinds of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like there's all kinds of alcoholics. And I found a meeting where I could just be. And I was so full of fear and paranoia and all that stuff rolling out of me, I was just hanging on. And I had some heavy stuff. That big book says that waves of the past will roll over you. I'd made a mistake, a terrible mistake. As I was sliding down the tube, I got a little greedy. I heard a story in Alcoholics Anonymous that kind of defines that. It was about a lion, a dog, and a fox that went rabbit hunting. And after a big day's hunt, why, the lion told the dog, said, Mr. Dog, why don't you divide the rabbits? The dog goes over and divides the rabbits up in three piles. And the lion comes up to the dog and he says, which pile's mine? And the dog says it doesn't make any difference. They're all equal. And the lion killed the dog. And then he turned around and he looked at the fox and said, Mr. Fox, you divide the rabbits. And the fox takes all the rabbits and pushes them up in one great big pile, takes one and lays it over to the side. And the lion said to the fox, said, which pile's mine? And the fox said, oh, the big pile. And the lion looked at the fox and he says, Mr. Fox, you're real smart. Where'd you learn how to divide rabbits? He saw from that dead dog over there. I'd have made a bad mistake. Some people had given me a quart food jar of pure Coke to deliver, and I didn't deliver it. I put it in a safety deposit box, and I went and hid out on my last drunk. And I hid out for 100 days. And when I crawled out of that motel room, and went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, had a couple of things that were unfinished, and I learned something from that. You know, if you're new and you're wondering about the steps, you're wondering when to work them, they told me I should work them immediately and the best of my ability. When I was 54 days sober, I called out of that place and I went down and made a phone call and called some people up and said, I got something I want to give back to you. And I met them in a little town up halfway between L.A. and San Francisco, and I walked across the parking lot and handed these guys a quart fruit jar of pure cocaine, and I said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic. Can't do these things anymore, and I can't hang around with you guys, and I just got a little different. And they took the things to get the hell out of their life and don't ever come back. And I turned around and I walked back to my car, and I discovered something on that trip. You see, every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. Every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. And every time I'd get up to that point, I couldn't stand the fear. It overrode my whole life, and I'd have to drink or use. And when I turned around and walked back to that car and I prayed to this God I didn't understand about, maybe they wouldn't bore a hole in me the size of a watermelon, I found that out, because on that ride back to my house, I discovered something about me. I had unconditional faith. Now I know where it come from. I had to walk in a man's office and tell him that I was sorry for some of the business deals I did with him, and that I had to make amends to him. He said, get the hell out of my life and never come back. And he put a contract on my life prior to that. And I had to walk in there and look him eyeball to eyeball at 55, 56 days sober and let him see me and look at him. And I walked out there and I don't know nothing about walking down the other side of that wall, but I know something that made me closer to you, because you said, just do it. And I sat around these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one meeting in particular, all kinds of weirdos in that meeting. There's a men's stag down in Anaheim, and I sit around in that meeting. I carried guns with me for 3.5 years of my sobriety. The first 3.5 years of my sobriety, I had a gun on at least one all the time. And I'd sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous down there on Friday night, and some guy sitting next to me, he'd say, I gotta quit molesting my 9-year-old daughter or I'm gonna get drunk. And I'd take my gun out of my boot, take a shell out, take a pen and tap pin, write his name on the bullet, someone will kill you right after the meeting. Put the bullet back in, put it in my boot, and put somebody else would call him. They'd be calling about robbing and stealing, and I'd take my gun out of the boot, write his name on the bullet, someone will kill you right after the meeting. Put the bullet back in there and put it in my boot. And pretty soon they'd say the meeting's over, and they all jump up and hold hands and pray, and I'd forget which one I was going to kill first. They'd hug me and say, keep coming back. And I'd go outside and stand around outside, and I'd be walking around, you know, just full of hate and anger, and people come up and say, how you feeling? I might just spit on them. I didn't know. You know, I just attack them, though. You just couldn't tell what direction I was going to fly, because it was just full of fear. And I don't know about these steps. I had to work them the best of my ability. And some guy told me to make a fear list. And I wrote down all these things on a piece of paper that I was afraid of. And it was just unconditional fear. And then he told me I was going to have to do an inventory. And I didn't know how to do an inventory. And I didn't even know how to pray. And here he was telling me I got to do this inventory. And I didn't memorize inventory. Took it all the way to Canada and shared with a guy, and I don't know what I said. Jim didn't know what he said to me, but I know one thing when he got through. It seemed to me like he said, if I could have done all them things, I wouldn't have quit. He said, you owe a herd of sheep the men's, and better quit pushing them cows on the lips, and you don't make any difference whether you're pitching or catching, you're still playing ball. And I don't walk around. Hey, you know, but you know, the thing the guy said was that I don't love you any less for all those things that you had to do. And I had to start making these amends, and financial amends rolled over me. And I found myself sitting in a chair across from a banker. And this kid owned the bank, and when he was a sophomore in high school, I jerked his pants down at the park and made him run around in front of the girls, you know. And here I am It's over about a year and a half, and I'm sitting across the table from this guy, and I'm asking if I can borrow some money. I'm telling him I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober, and I need some money. And he listened to me for about an hour and pulled a checkbook out and said, start writing checks. And I didn't understand that. I didn't know how to accept that. It even scared me more. And I had to take care of these debts. And some of them were mine, and some of them weren't mine, but they were laying on my shoulders, and I didn't know how to do that. And you just, all I was doing was just hanging on. And I stand around in a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous, and people would say, you got to learn how to forgive yourself. And I said, I don't know how to forgive myself. I mean, all this stuff's riding on my shoulders. I've taken credit for all this stuff I did. Some guy said, well, God can forgive you. Why can't you forgive you? And I'd say, because I ain't God. You told me that. Just anger, you know, and I'm standing around me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and pretty soon this guy comes up standing beside me, the weirdest looking guy you ever saw, man, and just hair in one direction and all weirded out and everything, and he nudged me and he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, hell, I don't know, and I run over, I said, I gotta ask my sponsor, and I run over and I said to my sponsor, I said, that guy wants me to be his sponsor. He said, yeah, I know, I sent him over there. So I went back over and I told him, I said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor because my sponsor said I had to. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I want to go home. And so I started out the door of this club, man, you know, and I kind of wanted to go out one door and let him go out the other. I didn't want people to see me run around with this guy. I told my sponsor, for crying out loud, at least you could have got a better looking one. And he got in the car and we're going down the street, and he just started talking to me about all this stuff. And just all this stuff was coming out of him. And he got about two blocks from his house, and he said, did you ever do any of that? I said, yeah. And I just started telling him all my stuff. And we pulled up in his driveway, and he looked at me, and he said, you're sick. You know that? I said, well, yeah, I'm sick, but I don't act on it anymore. Get out. And I'll see you at 8 o'clock. So I'm driving down. I think, you know, I never told anybody other than my sponsor that stuff. And here I'm telling this guy that stuff. Oh, what the heck, you know. And I go get him that night. We're going down the road with me. He's telling me more all this weird stuff. And he'd talk around them pretty soon. He'd say, you ever been in that? And I'd start telling him all my stuff. And pretty soon he'd stop, and I'd stop, and he'd look at me, and I'd look at him, and he'd say, you're sick, you know that? And I said, look, I don't want you to tell me. I'm your sponsor. You don't tell me I'm sick. Besides that, you got to be sick to recognize that it's sick. He just grinned at me, that stupid-looking grin, you know. We'd go along pretty soon. One day, he said, I want to do a fourth and fifth step. And I said, oh, okay. So I'll be over at your house Sunday to do my first step. All right. I sat in my house Sunday morning about 9 o'clock and there was a knock on the door. He went open the door and there was this ding-a-ling standing there. I mean, it looked like he'd hit him in the head. I mean, like one side was like this. It looked like one foot was in concrete and the other one was headed for Tijuana, man. I said, get in here, man. I don't want you standing. My neighbors see you out here. Had this old big book with all these papers stuck in there and everything. I took him in there and sat him down at the kitchen table and got him a cup of coffee and I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know. What do you want to do? I didn't know nothing. That would have been down to me. And I said, well, let's pray. So we got down on our knees and I put my arm around this guy and opened this big book up to the third step and I put my arm around him and I got a hold of him and I looked to see if the old lady and the kid were laying down. And because the guy told me I couldn't stay sober if I didn't get on my knees, so I got this dangling down on his knees and we're down there praying. We read that third step prayer together, you know. And, you know, just for a second I felt a little different there. You know, there was something there that I never had before. And hold on, this guy. He kind of smiling, and he jumped up when we finished that prayer and sat down at the table. He said, now I got to do my fourth step. And I said, I thought you did your fourth step. And he said, no, I can't write. And I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to tell you and you write it. And he showed this paper over there in the pencil, and he started telling me this stuff, and I started writing this stuff down, and pretty soon after I wrote a couple of pages, you know, it dawned on me, I'm writing this, and I said, sign in the margin here in case anybody finds this. I don't want to think it's mine. He went on and on, you know, and he pretty soon he'd ask me if I ever did anything like that or done anything like that, and I'd say, yeah, yeah, I probably did, and he'd say, you're sick, and I'd say, you're sick, shut up, keep going. And maybe after two or three hours, you know, why he got through saying all that stuff, and it was kind of quiet in there, and it was kind of a different feeling in that house. And I looked over at him, and I seen something about that guy I'd never seen before in anybody. Never seen it move many times, and I don't know, by then I was sober 2 years, 2.5 years. I'd never seen it myself before, but I knew it was happening to me because I could see it in him, and that guy didn't have that weird look at him anymore. He had a sparkle in his eye. He looked across that table and said, I love you. And I said, wow! I don't know if I ever had a man say that or not. He says, it don't make any difference, I love you. And he jumped up and went over there and threw his arms around me, and he grabbed me and he held me real tight. He wouldn't let go. I wanted to hit him. He held on. You know, the only time I ever felt anything like that was, used to be when I'd lie. When I'd get caught in a lie, a bold face lie, I knew it was a lie. The only defense I had was that if I said it 22 times, I might get you to doubt yourself. I might say it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until maybe I just see for a fraction of a second that glimmer of doubt in your eye and I knew I had you. Now this was in reverse. All of a sudden that Sunday morning something was happening to me. I knew there was a God in that room because two demons like us wouldn't have been down on our knees in front of God or nobody if there hadn't been one. And we wouldn't sit there and share all those things with each other, you see. I didn't know those feelings. When I gave my fifth step to my sponsor, I gave it to him, but I didn't get the full package until I took a fifth step. Because you see, it says in that 12 and 12 in there in that little prayer, it says it is in forgiving that we are forgiven. See, I was sitting around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous back there on the back row of 8, man. And I was saying, you can get it. You can get sober. You can feel good. Not me. Every family's got to have a black sheep in my mind. I'm a murderer. I'm a child beater, a rapist, a stealer, a thief, liar, all these things. And I ain't never going to feel good about myself, no matter what I do. You can do that. I did it till I almost died. I almost bled to death. You see, my walls inside of me from the dope and drugs is real thin, but the walls of hate were thick. And it almost killed me in sobriety. Hanging on to that hate. Hanging on to that fear. And you see, it's through you and the people that took the steps and share the experiences that we are forgiven, because this guy's sharing all these things with me and I identify with him and I'm forgiving him every time he shares these things. And what that did, it's cleansing me and I don't even know it. And that guy jumped up and we run up through the front door and he threw his arms around me again and he said, I love you. And he walked out the front door and I shut that front door and I turned around and I looked in that house and I looked up there and there was that woman standing there. This lady had been in my life for a long time through the insanity, and she didn't drink or do no dope. She was right in there in the insanity the whole time. And that little girl was standing there. And I saw something in them I'd never ever seen before to that day. I saw a little look in them that was different. I'd kind of seen it in my daughter, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, she had any other place to go, and she started going to Alateen. And I saw some things happen to her. And I'd been able to see her, you know, kind of come out of herself, and she stood tall, and I was able to go to a place and watch her walk out on the stage, and she was a model, and I stood in the back of the room a lot bigger than this, with a lot more people than this, and I stood back there and I watched her walk out on the stage, and she had some self-worth and some dignity, and she was modeling a very expensive dress, and I'm sober a little while, and I'm standing back of that room, and I wanted to cry out to those people, if you only knew what kind of animals we were, if you only knew where we come from. I couldn't. Because, see, I couldn't take no credit for that. I used to been going to these meetings every day, talking to my sponsor and working these stupid steps. And I watched her walk out on that stage, and there was something about her. I knew it was there because I cried, and there were tears of joy. But that morning, that Sunday morning, when I looked up and saw that little girl standing there, and I knew she had forgiven me for those things. And I knew I had forgiven me for those things. And I knew what love was for the first time in my life. You see, love for a guy like me is an action. The only thing I knew before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you said you loved me, I knew it was my turn. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you showed me what love was. You see, I didn't know what it was to have the actions that are involved in this program that makes you transparent. For a guy like me, the first act of love is transparency. I must let you see in so that I can see out. Now, when I did my first step, I let another human being see in. But I refused to look out because the fear overrode everything about me, unconditional fear. And yet, you know, when I shared with this other human being, when I passed it on, and then when I received it, I was able to see out. And I know today, you see, I'm as sober as I am secret. I got no secrets. I'm standing right here, and this is all there is. You can see in. There's nothing going on in my life that I can't stand here right now and let you see in. This is it. And the greatest gift of that is that, you see, if I'm as sober as I am secret, there is no gossip. And if there is no gossip, it's not necessary for me to walk out of this room tonight and have every one of you approval in order for me to feel good about me. I know I got that today, because ever since I woke up this morning, I've been all around, up and down, around, around, and I've seen all kinds of them, the tall ones, short ones, the rich ones, and the poor ones. I've seen them all. And from the second I woke up this morning to this second right now, I haven't seen one person that thought of anybody that I'd rather be than me. You see, you gave me that. You gave me that. You gave me that apartness. The second greatest act of love for a guy like me is to quit taking hostages. I gotta let you go. I gotta let these people go in my life. And for the first time when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did something for me, 100% for me. I came in here and I grabbed this thing. I'm obsessed with Alcoholics Anonymous. And an obsession is an idea that overpowers all other ideas. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only thing in my life. My job is just a place I hang out in between meetings. You see? It is. I'm unemployable when I'm drinking and doing dope, so it don't make no difference. This is it. And I come in here and you taught me that. You showed me that apartness. You come in here and when you're new, you see the newcomers and you look tonight in the years of sobriety and you see all these people stand up and then as you get longer in sobriety, there's less and less and less of them. You see, one of the neatest things about my life today is that there's people coming into my life. And before there was people leaving my life. There's people coming into my life. There's some longevity in my relationships today. With the people in my life. Oh, yeah, a lot of these new ones, they'll come in, they'll work the steps real quick, and then they'll run over here and fall in love, and then pretty soon them ding-a-lings will come over to you and say, my girlfriend says you're too sick to sponsor me. And then he'll go game another sponsor, and you'll think, God, what'd I do wrong? I give him everything I know to stay sober, and he fired me. And I run over to my sponsor, and I say to him, he fired me, and I told him everything there was to know about staying sober. Spent countless hours with this turkey, and he'd say, stupid. We don't take hostages anymore. Look around, there's another one stood right in his place, because this is just a passing parade. Let him go if he's got to go die. Love him enough to let him do what he's got to do. And when I was doing those things in Alcoholics Anonymous, it dawned on me that morning standing in that house that I was doing them at home. That I was allowing this lady to live her own life and this little girl to live her own life and that we had a relationship. It wasn't easy. Nothing's easy. this whole thing takes everything you got and then some. I mean, when I was a couple of years sober, I come running in the house. I'd been off up in Wyoming working, and I come running in the house, and I run in there and told my wife, I said, get in the bedroom. She said, no, I've been down on, I'm releasing your ass. So besides that, you're sleeping on the couch. I said, that ain't fair. I've been going to meetings. I'm spiritual. I've worked all the steps. She said, don't make any difference. It dawned on me after going a certain amount of hour and hour. But you ain't made love to me in years. You've raped me on a regular basis, and you're sleeping on the couch. And I laid down on the couch, and I'm laying there thinking, I'm saying, this ain't right. You know? This ain't supposed to happen to a guy like me. Long about 1 o'clock in the morning, both three neighbors living next door to me, they started mowing the backyard. Bedroom was back there, and she come roaring down the hallway, and she yelled at me, said, they're back there mowing the backyard. I jumped straight up off the couch, run down the hall, grabbed a 44 manual, run out the back door, and blow that hippie's lawnmower up right over there, man. Guys about that big around just destroyed that thing, and she ran right out the back door and threw her arms around and said, Betty, I just love you when you're a hero. Took me in there and throwed one on me, man. And them hippies moved out a few days later. I was single-handedly cleaning up a neighborhood that had been corrupt for a long time. Crazy, I mean crazy. And I don't know how these things happen, but I remember one day when I was going down the road and this lady was sitting there beside me and she's going to all these Al-Anon meetings and I knew there was something happening in our relationship. I knew there was communications there that had never been there before because she reached over and put her hand on my leg and said, Betty, I love you. You mean something to me. And I knew that day when I saw a little girl walk out on the stage that I was standing in the back of that room. She kind of smiled at me in that special smile because she saw me standing back there. And I remembered that my old man, I don't know, I've been sober a little while and he was sober a little while. And he and I met someplace out of town and we spent some time together and we talked about things and we talked about the things we did drunk and we talked about sober things. And see, I had this brother that he was mentally retarded, and he had a bruised head and a birthmark all over him, and he never had the mind of any more than maybe a year old. I don't know what it was, but he was a disgrace to our family. You see, I mean, me and the old man, we're falling down drunks, but this guy's a disgrace to our family. On many occasions, me and my dad, we might talk about who's going to have to kill us, boy, to put him out of the misery and get the disgrace out of our family. And because we got too drunk to do it, it never happened. And after a little bit of sobriety for me and the old man, this boy died of natural causes. And me and the old man was able to sit down and talk about those things and forgive ourselves for the thoughts that we had and thank some God we didn't understand that we didn't have to act on those things because we didn't have to live with that guilt. And see that truly this boy had more mentality than we did in his own way. And we were able to stand up and put our arms around each other and hug each other and, you know, have a special feeling that day and walk away from each other. And you know, it's a supposed to be type deal with the Father and the Son today. And I knew those things. And that morning standing in my living room when that guy took off down that driveway, I knew those things. They all kind of come back to me. And I remember the guy talking about something like that in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told a story about a little cobbler man. And he said this little cobbler man, he was a good cobbler man. All his life he worked hard and he worked in this little shop and he died of natural causes. He went to heaven and he's standing up there looking God in the eye and God said, you know, cobbler man, you were a good man all your life. And the only thing about you was you always had a little bit of doubt inside of you. There was always a little doubt. And the cobbler man said, yeah, God, you know, it was, you know, maybe if I could have just seen you once. Or maybe if I could have just heard your voice once, or maybe if I could have just felt your touch once, I'd have been sure there was a God. And God said, you remember one day, you know, it was a real cold day and a winter day, and a little girl come walking in your shop, and she was cold, and it was snowing outside, and you brought her in your shop, and you looked at her shoes, and she sat down there, and you took her shoes off, and you patched them up, and you warmed her feet up, and when she left, she turned around and smiled at you, and the cobbler man told God, yeah, I remember that. I remember that day. And God said, well, you remember one day there was an old bum come into your place, and he come in there, and he was hungry and broke, and he asked you for some money to buy some food, and you didn't have no extra money to give him, but you shared your sandwich with him, and you sat there and ate half a sandwich with this old guy. And when he left, he reached around and he shook your hand, and the cobbler man said, yeah, I remember that day. I remember that day. And God said, you know, one day there was a little old lady going down the street, and she was all fuzzled. She didn't know where she was going, and she was lost, and she come running in your shop, and you calmed her down, and you set her down, and you found out what her name was, and you called her son, and her son came and got her. And on her way out the door, she said, bless you, my son. And the cobbler man says, yeah, I remember that. And the God said, well, I'll tell you what, cobbler man, that little girl smiled was my smile. And that bum's handshake was my touch. And that little old lady's bless you, my son, was my voice. I was there all the time. You just couldn't see. Now, you know, if I want to believe that when I stood in the back of that room and looked at that little girl, and when that guy was standing in my front yard and I said, I love you, man. And when my wife put her hand on my knee and said, baby, I love you, you mean something to me. When my old man put his arms around me and said, I love you, son, that my God's talking to me, I can believe that. Now, you can say that ain't right, but you can't say it's wrong, because I'm sober and I'm free. You see, when I used to get out in jailhouses and nut houses, I was loose. I wasn't free. I was just loose. I'm free today. I'm free. You see, I had what I had confused with what I was. All my life, I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth, and I didn't even know how to do that. I really didn't. I didn't know how to do those things. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you showed me how to do those things. You showed me. You see, the meanest man on the face is that little old guy lives down the street, and he can wake up in the morning and go down there and take a shower and put some clean clothes on and walk in the kitchen and put his arms around his wife and say, baby, I love you, you mean something to me. And he can walk out of the kitchen, go into the other room, and he don't have to kick the dog or the cat, and he can put his arms around his daughter and say, baby, I love you, hoping you have a good day. Hoping you have a good day. And then he can go out the front door and he can get in his car and go down the street and he don't have to flip the crosswalk radio. And he can go to that job and work with them crackheads, and when the day's over he can get his paycheck and bring it home and put it in the bank and come in and take a nap. I mean, take a nap. And then he can get up and go to a place like this and he can laugh and cry and kiss them goodbye. And he can go home at night and put his head on that pillow and thank this God he really didn't know for another day. See, it takes guts to do that. It takes real guts to do that. You got to be responsible to do that. I didn't even know what responsibility was. Responsibility is the ability to respond. You got to get up off your ass and do something. And I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to be a husband or a father or an employer. I didn't know how to do those things. And I came in here and I asked you, show me. Show me how you do those things. And I said, I want to know about this God. And I went up to people and I said, talk to me about your God. How do you find this God? And they said, through prayer and meditation. And I said, is that all? And they said, that's enough. Just quiet. And I found out that for a guy like me, I had to get on my knee. And I told the guy, I said, I don't want to get on my knee. He said, well, just try it. If you're willing to try it, do it. I said, I don't even know how to do it on a regular basis. Well, you wear a cowboy boot. And now when you take your boots off, get down on your knees and shove them under the bed while you're down there, why? Say a prayer. Then when you get up in the morning, pull them boots off my head. You get down on your knees, pull them boots out, and you say another prayer. Real simple. I didn't know how to do that. First time they told me how to do that, I was out of town. Staying in a motel, this guy told me, just try it. If you do it tonight, get up in the morning, do it again, then call me. I liked everything except call me. I went to our motel room, I closed the blinds, I listened to see if anybody's awake in the other room. Took all my clothes off with my boots, and I went over and took my boots off and shoved them under that bed, and I was down there, I said, now what? I said, well, tell you what, God, to show you that I'm serious, I'll never say the big F word again. Jumped straight up, laid down in the bed. 15 seconds later, a guy called me up all the way. I was way off from Texas, and he called me up all the way from California and said, how in the F you doing? I said, real effing good. You know? He said, you're not going to believe it. I just promised God I'd never say that again. And I learned I can't bargain with my God, you see. But he forgives me, and he allows me to be me. And I'll never forget that I was standing in my living room one morning, and I pulled my boot, my pants leg up and dropped a comb in my boot, and my wife walked by and said, that's different. And I wasn't sticking a gun in that boot. And I didn't have to carry that around. I'm here to tell you I'm unarmed tonight. And that's a feeling. It's a good feeling. You see, the greatest gift of love of all is the gift of freedom. Freedom. To be yourself. Just to be. My book tells me that I have a purpose, and my purpose is just to be the very best me I can be. This is all there is. There ain't no more. And that's enough. It's enough. Just to be. But I might wake up and go in there in the bathroom in the morning like I do on many, many mornings, and I look in the mirror, and I look in that mirror, and I say, I love you. There's somebody home. There's something looking back. And it's a good feeling that I'm not ashamed to be me, that I can walk in dignity. And it ain't been easy. There's been a lot of ups and downs. I can't stand here and tell you that this road's been all that just rosy, because I had some humongous debts to pay. And I'm here to tell you that when I started writing them checks to that banker that day, I wrote $265,000 worth of checks. And I had no idea I could ever pay that back. And with the grace of God, I keep doing what I've been doing on July the 22nd, the next year, I will have paid all that back. I mean, you can't do that. There is no way to come from there to here. You can't do it. And I'd sit around me with Alcoholics Anonymous and hear some guy talk about getting things, and I'd say, where am I going to get mine? I want to get mine. They said, just keep coming back, just keep coming back, and you'll get it. And pretty soon it would. It'd come, and it'd come from the strangest places, because I could see. I could see. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like looking through a straw, man. And as I stood around here and worked these steps, it opened up. And I can see. And the greatest gift of being able to see is that there's something going on. There's life going on out there. And if sobriety isn't fun for you, you're doing something wrong. I'm full of enthusiasm today. And enthusiasm is God within. And I love life. And I love to go up to a newcomer and get a hold of them and hang on to them. Then they try to get away and you just hang on to them. And they'll look at you weird. And then you whisper, I love you, in their ear. But just for a second, they doubted themselves, and you knew they knew. And I love those feelings today. I love the feeling of laughter and the enjoyment of being able to come here. You see, one of the greatest gifts for a guy like me to stand here and look you in the eye, just to look you in the eye. And if you're sitting there and you're new, or if you're nearly new, or if you've been around a long time, and you never had a chance to come up here and stand here and share, stick around, stick your hand out, share with people. Don't stop on the fifth step. Go ahead and work the rest of those things so you can enjoy these things. I didn't realize that the fear of financial insecurity would lead me as soon as I made my financial amends. See, I forgot that part. I kept sitting around waiting for the fear of financial insecurity to leave me. And it finally dawned on me I had to do something. I found out that the fear of people goes away when you quit hanging around with people that want to kill you all the time. And I found out that those things that you will intuitively know how to do with, you will intuitively know how to get up and go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will intuitively know how to share with your sponsor if you call him on a regular basis. And I have to call my sponsor on a regular basis, and he talks Alcoholics Anonymous to me because he don't know nothing else. And he tells me, you got to do it because it works. And you got to stay small, and you stay in the trench, and you stay with them newcomers. And you get you a mess of them newcomers like I do, and I load them up, and going down the road, looks like a bunch of bird dogs hanging out the window. Man, they're all going down the road, and I'm going over to see my sponsor, and I take them over to see my sponsor, and we sit down here in the living room, and he gets in there and beats on the desk and tells them about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just sit there and smile, because I'd love to hear my sponsor talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, because he's been doing it for 24 years, and I love to feel those feelings. I love to see the hope and the faith, and I love to be able to come here and share that with you. That's the greatest gift of all, to be able to have the freedom to say when somebody calls and say, yeah, will you come and share, that I can say, yeah, because that's all I'm got to do today, just to come and share, to let you see in so that I might see out, to have the apartness to be able to come here and see you. And the beautiful thing about that is there's a guy sitting on this side of the room and a guy sitting on that side of the room that I've known for a long time. Long, long time. Long time. You see, I got long times today. It's good to see them. It's good to see people and to make new friends. And if you come down in my ear, my friends will be your friends. And that's a beautiful gift. It's the greatest gift of all. Don't cheat yourself of this thing. It's what it's all about. It's about living and loving and letting people see you for what you really are. Thank you.